Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Brainstorm. Today, we are joined by a very special guest. We have Nicole Kagan, Head of Research at Kalshi. Nicole, thank you so much for coming on. Want to just start with a bit of your background. What brought you to the prediction market space? What brought you to Kalshi? We'll start there and then get into some questions around prediction markets and Kalshi.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on, Nick. In the way of background, my name is Nicole. I'm head of research at Kalshi, which is the academic and institutional research arm of the prediction market, Kalshi. I also work on the markets team on the rules side, so doing a lot of the rules writing and the certification process with the CFTC. So see a lot of the ways in which the business operates. In terms of how I got to Kalshi, so right before my seat at Kalshi, I was in grad school for economics. I thought I wanted to be a professor. I realized very quickly I, in fact, did not want to be a professor. So I came to Kalshi to work with real data. But in terms of the prediction market focus itself, you know, before I went to grad school, I was actually a macro investor at Bridgewater Associates. And one of the things that I looked at was I looked at macro policy in emerging markets. And so I was looking at where short rates would be in 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, a year. And for people who don't know what short rates are, they're basically the policy rate. So you can think about it as where the central bank will set a rate, say 3 months from now or 6 months from now. And of course, you know, in many emerging economies, central banks are not independent of the government. So Turkey is a great example of that. Right? The Turkish Central Bank is widely known not to be separate from the Turkish government. So of course, you know, when you're a macro investor, you're trying to put these positions on where their policy rate's going to be in a certain period of time. But that's not actually what you have a view on, right? As a macro investor, your view is on who's going to win the next Turkish election and then what that will say downstream about central bank policy rates. And I think in my seat at Bridgewater, I thought a lot about why we couldn't just put a position on those events directly, you know, because the thing that I understood was what was about to happen electorally. What I did not understand at all was what that meant for short rates. Could mean absolutely anything across a bunch of different countries. And so I think that at that time, the idea occurred to me that, hey, like event contracts have a lot of value. They seem to make a lot of sense. But at the time, they didn't really exist as a financial instrument that you could trade, especially not as an institution. And so hearing about Kalshi, I was like, oh, well, this makes total sense. And as soon as I heard of the idea and I saw that there was a position open on the markets team, I very much jumped at the chance to take it.
Awesome.
So that makes you are the queen of monitoring the situation.
That's, yes. In fact, yes. That is exactly what people refer to me as here at Kalshi. Yeah.
And so the Federal Reserve put out a paper, Kalshi and the Rise of Macro Markets. Maybe you can dive into that because that seems right at the sweet spot of where you came from and where you're going.
Absolutely. So let me give you a little bit of context on that paper. So researchers at the Fed put out a paper called Kalshi and the Rise of Macro Markets. And in that paper, they say a few things, right? The first thing they say is when you look at certain markets that exist on Kalshi, so for example, inflation, they actually find that Kalshi estimates in terms of market pricing outperform consensus, which is a really big deal, right? Because if you're a financial institution, you put a lot of value on what consensus is saying. You know, these products, the sell-side research is pretty widely read in the buy-side community as well. And so to have a public platform where this price weighting is readily available to you be a better indicator than consensus and at no point worse is a really big deal, right? So that's the first thing that they said. The second thing that they said was that there's a lot of value in understanding the distribution of predictions that people are making. You know, and this is interesting because traditionally in financial assets, you look at a price, right? And that price moves through time, right? And those prices can be pretty noisy. But what you don't really understand about the way that, for instance, Fed funds futures are priced is the band of uncertainty around what the next decision is going to be, right? But what you can do with Kalshi markets is you can actually look at the data that underlies them and think about, okay, well, they say that the next, say, Fed rate decision is going to be that there's going to be a cut of 25 basis points. But we're actually really unsure about that. You know, we think it's going to be a cut, but it could be up to 75 basis points. It could be a huge cut, but we know that directionally they're cutting. Or it could look like we think they're going to cut, but also maybe they'll keep the rate the same. And that's actually a pretty big deal, right? Understanding the confidence with which people are approaching, say, the next Fed decision or unemployment prints or anything else gives you a confidence interval that people are operating within that gives you more context in terms of the market structure. And I think in terms of institutional investors, this is a really good way of understanding and getting a good pulse on what the market is holistically, as opposed to just having a point in time price snapshot estimate. And so I think you know, the Fed paper did a lot of work to examine the value of calcium markets, not only where there are existing financial parallels, but also where there aren't. So for things like GDP prints or unemployment, where there aren't traditional financial instruments that allow you to trade them. The other thing that I'll say that is kind of interesting about the Fed paper is 3 months prior to the Fed releasing this paper, Kalshi Research released a paper. It was our first paper, and it was called Beyond Consensus. And we said, hey, everyone, look, we're actually better at predicting CPI than consensus is. And at the time, people looked at this paper and they were like, okay, like, of course, Kalshi says that Kalshi is good at predicting things, right? It's kind of in the business of predicting things. It's totally in their interest. And 3 months later, the Fed goes and peer reviews that research completely independently and says the same thing. I mean, it's a very validating feeling, you know, from the perspective of a researcher to have that happen to you.
Nicole, as you think about where prediction markets are today and where they'll be in the future, mm-hmm. what do you think the total addressable TAM is? Because you can financialize and issue contracts for a wide variety. We've talked about economics. There's obviously sports betting. There's culture markets, mention markets. The list goes on and on. But where do you think the end state is? What do prediction markets look like in a mature state?
You know, it's interesting. I think that the total addressable market here is enormous, right? Presumably much larger than any market of financial assets that we've seen in the past, because for the first time, you're able to directly hedge out risk that is related to any event that you could come across, right? And I think that that's actually a pretty big deal, right? Like, if you can imagine the whole range, right? So from people hedging out their risk for hurricanes, for instance, by purchasing effectively parametric insurance via platforms like Kalshi, or even, say, FEMA understanding emergency response needs through the pricing on things like hurricanes coming through platforms like Kalshi, right through to traditional financial and macroeconomic assets, and the ability to hedge out not only those, but also granular items related to companies like their KPIs. I think it's just naturally an enormous class, because I think that the reality of public markets is they'll always exist, but public markets are very noisy. It is very difficult to know where stock prices, I mean, you know this better than anyone else, right?
Like, yeah.
It's hard to know which direction a stock price will move. Earnings could come out and be excellent, and the stock price falls for absolutely no discernible reason, right? And as an analyst, you might be completely correct in the way that you've thought about KPIs, all the deliveries, about all the financials, and still get the stock price movement wrong. And so I think as a natural way for people to express views that they have high conviction on, it makes a lot of sense as a platform across a wide variety of assets that you could potentially imagine.
And so what are the steps to get there? Right? Because it's like, obviously, mm-hmm. liquidity matters and underwriting matters. And so what are the steps in solving this somewhat chicken and egg problem of here's a brand new market for the first time, who's on the other side of that making that market? And then how do you get the volume there to get the better than consensus outcome?
Yeah, well, look, I think liquidity is the biggest unlock, right? Because the best markets are the liquid markets, the ones that people can feel freely able to trade in and out of. I think that those lead to the best price discovery. And of course, you know, we have our own forthcoming research on exactly how much liquidity you need in a market for it to have good calibration, or what we would consider to be, you know, a reasonable foretelling of the future. And it is, in fact, a lot lower than we think. Like, we're talking about potentially like the low thousands of dollars, low tens of thousands, you know, not thousands of participants, maybe hundreds, maybe even tens, maybe single digits in certain cases. But I would say that it really is a liquidity question. And I think that as the platform grows over time, you see it naturally accrue. You know, the first people that adopted are going to be retail investors that are willing to try something new. You know, and over time, institutions begin to see the value in platforms like Kalshi. You know, we just held our first research conference on Friday. We had a lot of institutions there that a year ago definitely wouldn't have been in the room. You know, and next year, you know, when asked, Tariq said on his own panel that next year, probably the room will be full of many more suits than it was this year. And I think that that's the thing. I think institutional adoption can be slow moving, but is probably going to be one of the more powerful forces in making sure that we entrench these markets into the mainstream.
How important was the margin announcement last week for institutions? It seems like, and I heard a bit at the conference around, you know, the value of money and how margin unlocks, you know, the time value of money and being able to put a lesser amount of upfront capital towards some of these bets. So how important is margin to institutions, and what are some other instruments that they're looking for to develop around prediction markets?
It's a good question. I don't know that we made any announcement about margin last week from our end. I do think, though, that margin is a natural next step for institutional adoption. in that I think that capital allocation and capital efficiency is unbelievably important to the people running the books. It's very rare that you'll see a large hedge fund put up a fully collateralized position. And so in order to be efficient from a capital perspective, having margin and access to leverage is going to be really important to have institutional access to markets and therefore benefit from the enormous liquidity that institutions are able to give to markets. And especially in the case that we have long-dated markets, this becomes very important, right? When we're talking about, say, elections that are happening in 2028, it's very important to have, say, institutional access to margin in those markets, because those are the kinds of positions that you would be taking out very far in advance, right? Where you can see that liquidity very, very early and you get the highest return on capital, but you don't have to post all that capital very early on. But I don't know that we, from our perspective, have said anything specifically about margin.
Yeah, maybe it was news that came out.
There's always a lot of noise, a lot of news that comes out about things. Very few of those releases ask us about our perspective on any of it. But I don't think we've said anything on our end.
Got it. Maybe you can help clear the air around some of the other criticism around prediction markets, especially on insider trading, because I think you do a lot, but you don't get credit for a lot. Help us understand the rules and regulation and what, you know, instruments you're putting in place to be able to find bad actors and illegal activity.
Of course. First of all, Kalshi, as you know, is a CFTC-regulated exchange, right? This means that we have to follow federal rules in terms of consumer protection, but also in terms of the markets that we list and how we surveil them. It also means that we have the full suite of referrals available to us. So for instance, if we find breaches of our insider trading policy, we can refer to the Department of Justice, to the CFTC, and for other various penalties. And we've been public about some of those penalties as it comes to fines. Of course, there's a lot of enforcement action that the public doesn't see, probably because it is not in anyone's interest to reveal that information. In terms of the penalties and the way that we monitor these markets, from a monetary perspective, we have very robust trading prohibitions across the variety of markets that we offer that lock out certain people from being able to trade in them, which means that if you are likely to have material non-public information about the thing that you're trading, you're often locked out of trading those markets. So for instance, politicians can't trade on their own campaigns, right? Company executives cannot trade on positions related to their companies. And by the way, I would say many of these rules actually are probably an extension of what currently exists for the stock market, right? They actually go a little bit further than what you see already in place for equity markets more broadly. And in terms of how we police them, I mean, we have a broad array of surveillance tools. Of course, insider trading is illegal on Kalshi. And we take that really seriously. You know, we monitor transactions, we monitor who they're coming from. And because we're regulated in the US and because we took that approach, we have KYC. So we know who is trading on our platform, which makes it much easier for us to trace that activity and to stop it when it happens or to prevent it from happening in the first place. And when we do find that it happens, we take enforcement action very seriously and we take it very quickly. And much of that, I'm sure the public will never hear about, but some, of course, the public has heard about.
Yeah, right. Probably more restrictive than what Congress people have on trading stocks.
Yes, anyway. I would say that is almost certainly true. Yes, yes.
What percent of people read the rules before betting?
I hope all traders read the rules. I couldn't give you an exact number. I think the reality is, like, there is probably some bias in most markets against reading the full rules, because people like to trade on simplicity. And as much as possible, you know, we make the rules simple and straightforward. There are some rule sets that are more complicated than others, right? They just take more explanation. There are more edge cases that you need to think about. And importantly, you know, I think really clear rules protect user interests the most. Mm-hmm. I think it's in everybody's interest to go and read the full rules, not just because we spend time writing them, but also because really they're kind of written to make the user's position better, to make it clearer what happens in cases that maybe otherwise are not so clearly settled. So I wish I could give you an exact percentage. I want to say 100%, but I don't know that that's exactly the case.
Because we've done a lot of, as a segment on the show, we'll often pull up a prediction market and then get people's guesses. And Nick and I are always debating the nuances of the rules.
Really? I actually had a good one in the Super Bowl around Anthropic and whether or not they would advertise, but it was specific to Anthropic's brand versus Claude.
Yes.
And once I realized what the exact rule was, it changed the way I placed my trade. And
yeah,
I
think a lot of user confusion would be alleviated with a really close reading of the rules, of course. You know, we're really meticulous about what we write, and you would have noticed that too about the rule set that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And that's all intentional, of course.
What are some of your favorite categories that are out there that you think are just, you know, so fascinating and are really only available because of prediction markets? Like, you just wouldn't get the exposure to this type of risk or market anywhere else.
Well, I mean, I think there are lots, right? Like, it's like having 100 children, right? It's like you probably have a favorite, but you can't say what your favorite is. I mean, as a macro trader by background, I love our macro markets. Like, I love our macro and financial markets. And I love that you're able to take positions on things that just do not exist as financial assets otherwise. Like, I think that's a huge unlock. But it's true of a wide variety of markets. I mean, even markets like our sports markets offer enormous hedging utility, right? Like, for the first time, you can think about the fact that you could insure yourself against the risk that you might encounter as an advertiser, as a sponsor, as a hotel that is associated with the team's performance, right? The first time you can actually hedge out that risk on extremely liquid markets to do with team performance over the course of a season, right, or over the course of a single game. And I think that that's very, very powerful. So I think that we're offering new ways to engage with different market structures for different players in industries that have traditionally gone to insurers or reinsurers that can now go directly to Kalshi for those things, you know, and that's true on sports. And then, of course, like, we have lots of other interesting categories, like culture we list. I think that you would rarely find markets like that anywhere else, right? Like, performance on different shows, different platforms, different cultural phenomenon that might come out. And of course, like, I think sometimes the thing that people don't realize when it comes to these categories like culture, right? I think they sometimes get dismissed by the public as not being very serious. But the reality is, like, they are multi-billion dollar industries, right? Like, after Love Island finishes, thousands of people fly to Turkey to get veneers, right? It's a multi-billion dollar industry there because of the kinds of cultural icons that have been shaped by shows like that, right? So it's very easy to dismiss certain categories as frivolous, but in reality, like, they control a wide variety of social outcomes. And I think it's cool that we get to capture that, right? In a really, really direct way.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about, I know we've talked about your first research piece that was out there.
Yeah.
You talked about another one you're working on. What are some other avenues of research that you're super interested in? And I know that, you know, one, it's a lean team, and two, you guys are very open to collaborations. And that's apparent even on the research side, where it is very easy to suggest a collaboration.
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of things that I'm excited about, right? So one thing that I think is really interesting, and I think should probably interest the Frontier AI Labs, is, you know, you can imagine that you can get at some understanding of how well AI models reason by thinking about the positions that they would take in different markets, right? So let's say you took all of our macro markets and you asked, I don't know, Claude, right, what position it would take on different markets. One thing that you could get at there is, like, okay, well, like, does it seem like the position that it's asking you to take on inflation is in line with what it's saying about Fed funds rates, right? Does it seem to automatically understand that there's a connection between the two, or is it placing discrete and idiosyncratic positions on those items? I think that's very interesting because it's one of the most efficient ways to proxy whether you're actually getting close to human reasoning or not really very much at all. And in terms of its use as an investment tool, I think that there's a lot of room, right? That right now, in terms of institutional investment, the way that it's integrating this new technology. And I think as a result of that, there is a lot of interest in the industry in understanding whether or not these tools truly are predictive and truly can mimic the way that an analyst would think about markets, in which, of course, they would think about in a correlated way, right? Like, you wouldn't assume that inflation, the price of oil are completely disparate signals. You might actually think that they're closely related. And so it's interesting to track through time whether you do see that. I think that's a really interesting frontier of research, but I think that there are many others. You know, I think you can drill into other questions like breaking down political campaigns and the way that prediction markets serve as credibility layers on information that is coming through. Because you can imagine, you know, some news moves prices, other news doesn't move prices. And the natural question, of course, is why, right? What is moving the price and what isn't? What is it that people are actually reacting to? And for a long time, people have tried to do this kind of decomposition in traditional stock markets, but it's hard because big public markets are very noisy. They have lots of components. But prediction markets are substantially less noisy, and you can go ahead and decompose in this way. So I think there's a lot of really interesting granular analysis that you can do now with the data that we have that you couldn't do before, right? And then in addition to that, the last thing I'll mention on this, I mean, I could go on obviously for hours, like, this is exactly the topic that you should have asked me about, is there are lots of sectors that I think we haven't penetrated deeply enough yet. So things like pharmaceuticals, right? The way that clinical trials work and their success and the way that that's projected by different members of the public or their reactions to them is very, very interesting, right? And I think that that's an entirely new area of research that we could look into too.
We're happy to have our research team collaborate on that one.
Perfect.
Do you think that new industries are going to pop up as a result of the ability that prediction markets give to offload risk? Like, I'm always struck, and you were at Bridgewater, and maybe this is an entirely made up story, but it's always stuck with me that Ray Dalio was a part of the creation of the chicken nugget because he was able to use futures to lower the stock, like chicken feed, so that chicken McNuggets could be affordable. And I always find that story fascinating, whether it's true or not. And maybe you can confirm, because people don't understand that financial instruments being able to offload risk allows entrepreneurs, individuals in the market to take on more risk. And as a result, you have new markets that arise. Is that like a true statement, given you're at the forefront, you're seeing this, you're looking at the cohort of users that have come on? Like, is that true? And do you think it will be true in the future?
I mean, what a legacy, really. I don't know that I can ever match the creation of the chicken nugget. I can't tell you if that's true or not, but that's a great story. In terms of new industries, I hope so. I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense, right? And there are companies that you can speak to now, like Gainpoint Capital, like Arrived, that use prediction markets to hedge out risk. So there's a company called Arrived that hedged out risk to do with the government shutdown, right? Mm-hmm. When it happened last year and it was highly disruptive. I think that we will probably see an entirely new version of the insurance industry come into prediction markets to take on this kind of parametric insurance that these contracts naturally offer. I absolutely see that. And I'm sure that there are industries that I haven't even thought about yet that will start as a result of these prediction markets existing.
Yeah.
And then maybe to circle back on the liquidity question.
Yeah.
Right. That's the key. There's a power law dynamic between the most liquid and least liquid markets. Are you surprised which ones get liquidity? And then how do you make sure that the markets that are important get liquidity? And obviously, in like a perfectly efficient market, it just shows up. But I feel like that's not how it works, especially as people are just getting introduced to this concept.
Well, so to answer your first question, am I surprised? Not really. Sometimes I'm surprised by how much liquidity certain markets get. You know, like the next chair of the Fed got, I think, $200 million or something like that. I think that that's probably an order of magnitude above what I thought it would get. But I think naturally interest gravitates to the things that are topical and relevant. And so it's not surprising that the markets that attract the most liquidity are the ones that are either macroeconomic staples or the ones that are the most talked about. In terms of how we think about liquidity going forward, I think that there are markets that are of natural interest to different players, right? So retail investors are interested in one set of markets. Institutional investors might be interested in a different set of markets, potentially a more traditional set of markets to what you currently see them being involved in. And so I think over time, the concentration of liquidity will probably change and broaden out, right? As you think of different use cases for different markets and different participants in those markets. I think that in terms of what you can do to make them more efficient, I mean, you can promote the markets, of course, but you can also create incentives, right, for market makers to join markets. You can do things like removing fees on certain markets. You can do things like rebating fees for market makers, depending on how much liquidity they're providing in line with the obligations that we set for them. So I think that there are many ways in which you can spur liquidity to join a market. You can never guarantee liquidity, even where you think it might exist. But I think broadly speaking, there's nothing hugely surprising about where you see the pools of liquidity going.
Awesome. Well, Nicole, this has been great. Thank you for informing us and setting the record straight on a few topics as well.
Yeah.
Really appreciate it. We'll have to have you back on. For everyone, ARK and Kalshi are now partnered. We're working together to surface interesting markets for the crowd and for the crowd to then impart their wisdom on all of us. So really excited about the future. Nicole, thank you so much for coming on. And congratulations on the conference as well. I've told you this as I was leaving, but it was amazing. Excited for the next one. Great job overall.
Thank you so much for coming, and thank you for having me on the show. This is fantastic.
Of course. ARK Investment Management LLC is an SEC-registered investment advisor. ARK, Wolf Financial, and Public are separate, unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to any company marketing or selling the products or services of the others. ARK, Wolf Financial, and Public make no representation or warranties regarding and expressly disclaim any responsibility or liability for any acts, omissions, losses, or damages of the other entities or their affiliates, officers, employees, or agents. No company shall be liable for any indirect, incidental, consequential, or special damages arising out of or in connection with this podcast or its contents. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARC, and investors should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARC and or show guests and are not endorsements by ARC of any company or security or recommendations by ARC to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARC's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statement. ARC assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARC and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily, have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARC believes to be reliable. However, ARC does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.